Hi everyone, my name is Bassem and I'll be chairing the session today, so it'll be nice and intimate. So it's my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Adam Butt, who is Associate Professor of Actuarial Science and Statistics at ANU. Prior to entering academia, Adam worked in superannuation consulting. He's a Fellow of the Institute of Actuary and has been since 2005. He completed his PhD at ANU in 2011. He has had his research published in a number of top-ranking actuarial journals, in addition to winning the ANU College of Business and Economics Award for Teaching Excellence in 2013. Adam's also developed a massive open online course, MOOC, for the EDX platform, titled An Introduction to Actuarial Science. And that's what he'll be speaking about today, and he'll be telling us about his experience developing the course and running the course and its implications for actuarial education and the broader profession. So welcome, Adam.
Thanks, Tim. Okay, let's start by asking you a question because that just makes things more interesting. The reason I'm asking this question will become more obvious later on, but just go with me for the moment. When you were first deciding, when you're first choosing to become an actuary, to take actuarial exams or whatever the pathway was for you, why did you choose the actuarial profession? And I want actual answers. Shout stuff out. I'll repeat them into the microphone so people listening later can hear. Yeah?
I like maths and I wanted a job that was in the business world, not in the science
background. How did you find out about the actuarial profession?
Funnily enough, I lived in a small provincial city in New Zealand. I had a friend whose brother was Sydney, and he told me
about it. Okay, cool, awesome. Anyone else? Yeah?
I had a master's degree and I was a graduate intake to AMP, and they said, oh, you've got a master's degree, you're doing actuarial.
Nice, nice. Anyone else want to share their experience? Yes, Colin?
I like master's, so I imagine most people here have said the same sort of thing.
Yeah.
So how I found out about it, to be honest, I can't remember. But it was some sort of research. No, I definitely remember that I didn't get career advice, no teacher or anything like that said, you might want to be an actuary, because somehow I worked out.
Okay. Yeah?
Also, like
Matt,
and
I
wanted to go to business school, but I wanted to go to medicine. And I did a career in counseling course at the university that I attended as a teacher, and they were more
Okay, so sort of similar broad experience, liked maths, wanted to do something practical with that, different ways of finding out about it. Okay, the reason I'm asking that will become relevant later on. Let's move on. Here's my agenda. So I'm going to give you a little bit of background to what MOOCs are. Who's done a massive open online course? Awesome.
Just started, yeah.
So you've enrolled, is what you're saying? Yeah, the marketing people will count you as having done a MOOC. So, okay, I'll give you a little bit of background to what massive open online courses actually are. I'll talk a little bit about my particular course, Introduction to Actuarial Science, and then what I want to spend not too much time of me talking about, but I want to ask you some questions, is what impacts these types of courses might have on particularly the actuarial profession, not so much higher education. Here's a little graph. Or a figure, I should say, to start with. So the massive part of massive open online courses typically means a very large number of students. Some of them have over 1 million students. These are huge, huge numbers of people. Open generally means that all of the learning material is freely available to any student. You can pay for the course if you want. So edX, the organisation that ANU is affiliated with, offers a verified certificate. It costs you $50 to pay for. Not really sure what it's useful for, to be perfectly honest, and very, very few students actually pay for it. But in any case, if you don't pay for it, everything is still freely available to you. Online should be fairly obvious what that means. Courses can be lots and lots of different things. So in particular, my course had both... No, not the next slide. I thought that might work. My course had both a synchronous version where the students would all go through the course at the same time. You'd reveal material in weeks going forward. And the idea is that you have a big enough group that there's a critical mass of people engaging with each other on discussion forums and things like that. It's now running in self-paced mode where all the material is available to start with and you can literally just do it as fast or as slow as you want to. Here are the main players. So Coursera and edX are the two biggest ones out there. Most of these players started around about 2012, so these things have been around for about 5 years or so. Coursera is the biggest. It's got about 15 million users as of September 2 years ago, so it would be a lot bigger now, and it's got over 2,000 courses. It was founded at Stanford. edX is the organisation that ANU is affiliated with. It was founded by Harvard and MIT, also back in 2012. You can see the other partners up there as well, so some pretty well-known and well-respected universities are involved. Last time I checked, it had about 1,500 different courses across all sorts of weird and wonderful stuff. I mean, I've written the basic ones there. There's a jazz appreciation course on edX, if that's your thing. You can take all sorts of funky things. And it's got over 5 million users. Now, ANU itself has offered MOOCs on astrophysics, Engaging India, Ignorance, and Surviving a PhD in the past. So all sorts of funky things. Now, the question I get asked all the time, so I guess I'll preempt it now, is why would universities want to offer these things? What's the business model? The universities would tell you that, well, we're all about public access to education, so opening up access to the world, which is nice. I suspect there's also a fairly strong element of branding and promotion involved in these things as well. If Cornell and Berkeley are going to offer MOOCs, then ANU need to offer them as well. I'm being recorded as I say that, so I probably shouldn't be so cynical, but there's certainly an element of follow the leader going on as well. Here's my course, Introduction to Actuarial Science. It first ran in a synchronous version at the end of 2015. It's been running self-paced from then on. Here's where we get back to. Actually, let's not show this slide just yet, because I don't want you just reading, and I'm not going to read that out, because you can all read. I asked you before why you became an actuary. I didn't really have an intention to create a MOOC. It wasn't something on my career to-do list to tick off. What happened was back in towards the end of 2013, we got an email from the Vice Chancellor of the university saying, put your 200-word proposal in for the next round of MOOCs at ANU. They'd already run the astrophysics and the India one. They thought they were successful. They wanted to run some more. First thing that stuck out to me about that note is that I only had to put 200 words in. Now, in any big organisation or university, it's been a while since I've worked in the corporate world, but to get anything done involves pages and pages and pages of paperwork. I thought, 200 words, wow, that's exciting. I've never seen something that important have so little a proposal requirement before. And then I thought about it. I thought back to my experience of how I became an actuary, and it's not too dissimilar to yours, but let me tell you the story anyway. I was at high school. I liked maths, just like everyone here. I was chatting to my careers advisor, probably in year 11 or something like that, and we were talking about what my career options were. And she said to me, "You should consider becoming an actuary." And I went, no idea what an actuary was. I asked her, "Well, what's an actuary then?" She gave me exactly the same look. "Oh, this is just what it tells me. If you're good at maths, you should become an actuary." And I remembered back to this, you know, it was 15 years ago at the time. And I was thinking, wouldn't it be great for people considering an actuarial career to actually have some sort of interactive resource? I know there's videos out there now where you get uncomfortable-looking actuaries describing their career and all of this sort of stuff. But wouldn't it be great to have an interactive version of some sort of course where students could go, okay, that's sort of what actuaries do, to make a decision beforehand? And so that was the catalyst. And this is the 200 words that I wrote, which I'll leave up for a moment so you can read if you want. I'm not going to read through the whole thing. But certainly the focus on the course was to target people considering a career in the actuarial profession to give them some basis for making a decision before they started doing either Society of Actuaries exams or a university degree or something like that. So this was back at the end of 2013. We got approval for it in April 2014. 18 months from then to starting the course sounds like a long time. I wasn't developing the course for the full 18 months. There was other stuff going on as well. But that's the timeline. By the way, if you've got any questions at all, please feel free to ask as we go along. anyway, I thought that sounded like a good way to find out about the profession. Okay, so writing the course was very much driven by that target market that I was talking about. And I've talked about the second bullet point already. When in the initial stages of planning, I didn't want this to be 1 week of maths, 1 week of statistics, 1 week of economics, 1 week of finance. I wanted it to tie it together in some way so students could actually see it in a way that was relevant to at least one practice area. I ended up choosing life insurance, not because life insurance is particularly any more awesome than any other practice area that actuaries work in. It was simply because I felt that life insurance was going to be the easiest practice area to tie everything together in some sort of coherent whole. And I'll show you some of the guest people I got involved in the course later, but they ran the gamut of all sorts of different practice areas, so students were getting exposed not just to life insurance as well. Course looks like this. I'll just go through this really quickly. The first two are basically your valuation of cash flows, so financial mathematics. These are the mortality stuff to link it into life insurance. This is where all the maths was. Working out how much maths to put in this course was really difficult. I didn't want to make it too mathematically complicated so I'd lose everyone immediately, but I'd be falsely selling the profession if I didn't have a decent amount of maths in there. So there's a little bit of calculus-y type stuff in here, but nothing so bad that if you got lost, you wouldn't be able to continue on anyway. I have certainly learnt from being on the discussion forums over the 18 months that this course has been running to don't overestimate the ability of people who want to take this course. There's a lot of people who are interested who don't really have the maths background, so sort of nice that they can go through it anyway. Value uncertain cash flows, that's sort of tying all this together. And then lessons 6 and 7 are really the meat, where students are actually required to take what they'd learned previously and build Excel models where they're actually simulating forward the experience of a life insurance company. I'll show you an example of a question they had to answer in lesson 6 in a moment. How does this look in the MOOC version? Well, there's loads and loads of evidence to suggest that people generally have about 3 to 8 minute attention spans for videos online. So that is the way I structured around 3 to 8 minute videos. I did get some awesome guest lecturers. I mean, no one wants to look at me for the entire course. That would be boring for both me and for everyone else. So I got, you'll see a couple in a moment, but I got presidents of the Institute and actuaries of the year and some really awesome people to agree to do this pro bono for me, which is fantastic. I interviewed them as well, so they weren't just delivering course material. I interviewed them and asked them questions about their careers. This is then interspersed, so these videos are interspersed with questions that students answer, testing what they've learned so far, and discussion forums as well. When this course was running in synchronous version, I'd be on the discussion forums for about an hour a day answering questions. I still go on there twice a week, but it doesn't take very long in the self-paced version. The other really nice thing about discussion forums is I could ask non-numeric questions there, which I can't really do in the accessible questions. So to give an example, one question I asked in the discussion forums was, do you think it's reasonable to make the assumption that people who buy life annuities have the same mortality experience as the general population? Pretty simple question for us actuaries, but led to a lot of interesting discussion with people who don't have that sort of background. And I wanted to encourage people to think not just in terms of numbers, that the actuarial profession certainly is not just about numbers. Okay, here's a little best of video of the course so you can get a bit of a feel for what the course structure looked like. This goes for about a minute and just splices a few different videos together. Knowing what you know now, what do you value most about being an actuary?
Well, the thing that I find in talking with a lot of clients, a lot of very senior people within the insurance industry, is what a fantastic reputation that the actuarial profession has.
Not only will it sell just one type of policy, but it's only going to sell those policies to one particular policyholder cohort. In other words, all of our policyholders are identical both in gender and in age.
In this video, I'm going to take you through the simulation of an insurance company from scratch. Now, we're going to start from the single projection that we did earlier in this lesson. And what we need to do is to turn all of these cash flow elements or things that drive cash flows into matrices like we looked at in the previous video. So what we're going to do in terms of structuring this is we're going to keep this worksheet, but we're going to call it inputs
and outputs.
So you get a bit of a feel for how the course is structured there. This now doesn't like me because I've done that. Here's an example question. This is from Lesson 6, the one I was mentioning before. You can read the whole thing if you want, but what I wanted to point out is that the last part of the question here, students are being asked to calculate the premium to be charged to give a 90% probability of sufficiency. So this is a simulation exercise. It's pretty complicated questions to ask people who may have no actuarial background at all. In order to get this to work, I created a template so students were using exactly the same random numbers, otherwise different people would get different answers. You enter your answer here. You can check whether it's correct there. If you just want to save your answer but don't check it, you click on that button. And then either once you've got the answer correct or you've used up all of your three submissions, you click on Show Answer, and there's a video solution to the problem that shows after that as well. Has anyone got any questions they want to ask at all? Nope. Okay, I'll skip through the next few slides nice and quickly. This is really more about experience of putting the course together. So I had to do tons and tons of marketing, learnt lots and lots about marketing that I had no idea about before. So we had an about video for the course enrolment page, which I've got in the presentation, but I'm not going to show you because every time I show it, it's just really embarrassing. It involves me walking down corridors, a current affairs style, holding folders and demonstrating how knowledgeable I am, but it's to draw people into the course, I guess. It's not that important for this environment. Lots of other animated videos for social media. We'll skip that. I did a Reddit Ask Me Anything. Does anyone here use Reddit? Cool. Reddit's pretty awesome. It's basically a discussion forum for any topic you could ever imagine in the universe. So it's sort of like this central discussion forum. And so I did an Ask Me Anything, which is basically you can ask me any question you want and I answer it. There's the date US style in the picture there. You have to prove that you're who you are, so you can't sort of say, I'm John Howard and I'm going to do an AMA. So you have to prove yourself. So that's my proof video. Lots of other media. You can see these links here. So if you care about this stuff, have a look at the presentation afterwards and click through all the links. But lots and lots and lots and lots of marketing stuff to do. Took up a fair bit of my time. Money. We're actuaries. We care about money. I was given $90,000 by the university to do this. I'm cheap. It only cost me $25,000. I had grand plans when I started this process of filming really expensive videos where you have like cutscenes of people in offices and really funky, you know, as if I was a filmmaker type thing. I realised pretty quickly that was going to take a huge amount of time, and secondly, that it didn't really matter for what I was trying to teach. So basically what you saw before was the gamut of all the different styles of videos, interviews, my guest lecturers did stuff in front of an animation to introduce each topic, me to camera stuff, which is all done in my office, and then video capture of the Excel stuff that I was doing. And that was about it. All of that cost, I don't know, $5,000. I got a pretty funky camera out of it for the university to pay for. It's at the university. I'm not using it for personal use. Had to pay for animation and captioning and get all the guest lecturers to come down. That was awesome. I mean, Estelle Pearson was the president at the time when she did that. Peter Martin was the actuary of the year, so it was great to have people of that level of seniority involved. Here's some more numbers, actuarial stuff. So this is to give you a bit of a feel for the reach of these courses. So the top number there is the number that all the marketing people get excited about, which is the total enrolments. Now, literally, an enrolment means I click on enrol in this course, you are now enrolled. If you do zero after that, you're still included in this number. That's why the marketing people love this number. It's split across the synchronous and self-paced version of the course. So we can see there's sort of over 30,000 people have signed up to this course. Let's go down here. Pass the course. You had to get 40% to pass the course. It's about 900 students. Now, critics of MOOCs will divide 900 by 30,000 and get 3%, if my maths is correct, and say you've got a 3% pass rate. That's atrocious. It's worse than the Part 3 pass rates. Well, yes, that's true, but that's missing the point completely. The vast majority of people in this collection, you have absolutely no intention of completing the course when they enrol. It's free. You just click on it and have a look, and then you leave and forget all about it. So we're working with a completely different dynamic here than people who pay for a course. The other numbers are just to give you a bit of a feel for what the progression in the course is like. So as I said before, you can pay to get a verified certificate. Not many people do. Very, very few, even though it only costs $50. This is the number of people who attempted the very first question in the course. So getting up towards 6,000. This is the number of people who attempted the first question in the second lesson. So we've lost half of them, or half of these guys and girls already. The number who attempted the very, very last question in the final exam, 500 or so. So the attrition rate is pretty high, which is okay. That's just the nature of these things. Student location. This is a great slide. I love this one. This is the world, obviously. The darker the colour, the higher the proportion of students that came from that country. So number one, this is for the synchronous version of the course, was the US with 21%. Number two, India with 16%. India is a massive market for edX. China is not particularly large because of the issue of YouTube being banned in China. And all the videos are hosted on YouTube, so that's a little bit problematic. Australia was the next highest at 7%. But you can see that that's the top three. It adds up to, less than 45%. It's 175 countries that people have enrolled from. Just for your interest, there was one from South Sudan, one from Andorra, and one from Afghanistan, among others that there were only one for. Pretty significant reach. Yeah, good question. So that is enrolments. That is the 30,000 number I was telling you about before. I don't know about passes, actually. You can't get that directly from edX, but you can download information that would allow you to split things up like that. I haven't looked into that. I should do that in future. I'm going to show you some results now from an opening survey we did in the synchronous version of the course. Now, if you can't read this, don't worry too much. I got lazy and just did a screen grab of this and didn't put it in my own table. But this is basically asking students, what is your prior background before taking the course? What I found really interesting here is that these top three rows, which add up to 23%, are all the people who don't have any form of university degree. So only 23% of students don't have at least a bachelor degree, which is a little concerning because I thought, well, hang on, are we actually meeting our target market here? It turns out that, anecdotally at least, loads and loads of students who I've had interactions with on the discussion forum are math degrees who are working in an area and they're thinking of a career change. So we're still capturing, I guess that still is the target market. This is going to be very hard to read, but don't worry. This is the motivation for taking the degree. The top five rows here are basically either I am already doing actuarial science and I want to make sure it's the right thing, or I'm considering it in future. The bottom two, the 38% there is I'm just interested, but I've got no intentions of pursuing it as a career. The last one, 2%, I'm already an actuary. Interesting. I think some of them at least are my colleagues at ANU who are having a little bit of a check out of the course. Probably one of them is me, actually. I suspect I filled this out at one point in time. Here's some feedback. This is the public feedback. So if you go onto my course page at edX, you'll see the course reviews. There might be a couple more than 15 reviews now. I've got one particular open-ended comment here because I like the fact that it is basically reflecting that it's meeting the aims of the course. So this is a US person. For anyone thinking of the US exams, I think this is a better first step toward becoming an actuary than focusing on statistics and probability for the first exam because it gives a better impression what the professional environment and processes might be like. Yay, that makes me excited. But it has been well received, very well received, the course. We also asked at the end of the course what students' future intentions were after the course. The number of responses here is much lower because we lost students along the way. But the top three here are, number one is, I am not currently studying actuarial science, but intend to do so in future, 41%, which is cool. This is, I have no future intentions, this will be the only study I do in actuarial science, 35. They made it all the way to the end of the course to say that, which is pretty amazing. Next one, 15%, I am currently studying actuarial science and intend to continue doing so. Next is the impact of the course. So what impact did the course have on you? Four rows. The top two were that I haven't changed my intentions. This question is sort of linked back to future intentions, and I'll talk about the link in a moment, but this is just the generic responses. Haven't changed my intentions, the course had a significant impact in affirming this, or the course didn't really impact my choice at all, 50 and 32. These were, I've changed my intention, the course had a small impact on changing, 4%, the course had a big impact on changing. if we just include the people who are studying actuarial science or about to study actuarial science in this table, then the numbers change to, this becomes 63 and 16, so the course has had a very significant impact in me deciding to do actuarial science, even though I already planned to. This becomes 1 and 20, which is good. I would be concerned if this was high. I have changed my intentions. I'm not going to become an actuary. And the course had no impact on that. Sorry, I've decided to become an actuary, but the course had no impact on that at all. So that's sort of quite exciting. Here's some open-ended comments. I'm going to go through these nice and quickly because these just end up making me look good, and that's not really the aim of this presentation. But lots of positive comments about the impact the course had. Let's skip through this nice and quickly. Now, here's the bit where we can start talking about the impact that these things might have, which I think is really the most interesting thing for this audience. I'm going to skip through this slide fairly quickly because it's not a higher education audience. But how might MOOCs affect higher education? Well, I think it is inevitable that online degrees will become even more prevalent. They are quite prevalent now. Basically, the way they tend to work now is that you'll learn all of your material online, then you'll sit some sort of invigilated examination at the end of it. That's only going to increase. I do think more learning material will be made freely available online, although I don't think that will be necessarily for structured degrees. So most of MOOC material at the moment is pretty introductory in nature. It's there to draw you into a topic, and then you might need to go and do a degree if you want to know more about it in future. I think it's inevitable that will be a rationalisation of on-campus providers. If you're a small institution without a huge amount of prestige, it's going to be difficult to sell the value of your degree, your on-campus degree, over a degree that's, well, it might not be a degree, over learning that's freely available online. So for those types of providers, they'll have to work very hard to differentiate their online, and or they'll have to differentiate themselves, their on-campus offerings, from online offerings. I mean, this is not an issue for your Harvards and your MITs. If you go to Harvard, you're paying for the fact you've gone to Harvard as much as you're paying for the education at Harvard and the networks and connections that gives you. But I don't know what the level is below that, but there becomes a level where there's a question about what the value of the degree is. Luckily for us, universities teaching actuarial science, we have the accreditation, which provides that value. That's higher education. Here's where things get more interesting. How will MOOCs affect professional qualification? I got so many questions from students. I still get them from students. Firstly, asking, how does this help me pass the society exam probability or exam financial mathematics? And my answer is it doesn't. That's not the aim of the course. Next question, when are you going to create a MOOC that helps me pass the society exam probability or exam financial mathematics? My answer, that's not the purpose of the course, and I don't have any plans of doing that in future. But there's clearly a desire for this sort of learning. Now, contrast this with the fact that associations do and always will hold the qualification key. So it's not as if I can, you know, provide accreditation from the introduction to actuarial science MOOC. The associations will always hold that key. So for most MOOCs, they're pretty irrelevant from a qualification perspective. They're more for personal development. But what I wonder is, what if, and I'm just going to use the accounting profession as an example, what if the accounting profession decided that we're going to make all of our learning material freely available online, you still have to pay for an exam, and that's how the business model works, they're just funded by people paying to take the exam, but what if they make all of their learning material freely available online? Why would they do that? I can see one particular reason of doing that would be that's going to help us attract the best students because it's a marketing ploy to show the world what you'll learn by becoming an accountant and to draw more students into starting the process, and then hopefully they'll go the whole way and choose to take the exams at the end. It doesn't really work for things like medicine, I guess, because of the significant hands-on elements. Might work for law, but they're pretty snooty, so they probably wouldn't want to make all of their learning material freely available online. Could definitely work for engineering, I would imagine. I think this is a big issue. I think it will happen. and this is just a personal view, it's not my university's view or anything like that, but I think it will happen. One profession at some point in time in the future will decide, yep, we're just going to make everything freely available online for promotional reasons. Once they do that, I think the other professions are sort of forced to, at the very least, respond in some way or another. In a related matter, I fear a little bit for the value of the FI, the fellowship of the Institute. And the reason for that is that with the diminishing amount of legislative work in Australia, which has been happening for decades now, the FIA has to stand up in of itself as being of value. Now, I've had a number of conversations with employers over the last 5 years or so where they have told me, well, we don't really feel like students are learning that much from the Part 3 exams. There's all this material freely available out there that students can ensure their own professional development that way. I don't need my employees to be fellows of the Actuaries Institute, so why would I encourage them to become fellows? And I think it's a big concern, because unless we can show that the FIA has value outside of just the restricted legislative regulatory work that actuaries do under their fellowship, I think there's a danger that we'll struggle to keep people going for fellowship designation, because they won't see the value in the designation outside of... Yeah, well, they'll feel it's better just to learn, to do their CPD online another way. But I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. That's a point for discussion. Last slide. How will MOOCs affect professional development? I'll go through these fairly quickly as well. I do think there'll be a significantly reduced market for training companies that want to charge you $1,000 to take a one-day SAS course. I think that's most certainly a dying market. I mean, this is already happening, and the Actuaries Institute is starting to move into this direction. Professions will either create or sponsor MOOCs as formal CPD activities. Again, the Institute is sort of moving in this direction at the moment, but it'd be great if I could go onto the Actuaries Institute website and say, this is where I want professional development here, and they would provide me with a series of courses as a recommended pathway. They're starting to do that, but it's not really very far along that track yet. And I guess on top of this, people will be taking control of their own professional development. There's so much out there for free. Some of it's fairly introductory, but there's tons of stuff on data analytics and machine learning and things like that for free available online, and people will just take control of their own learning. That's it. Thank you for listening. Questions? Or claps? I don't care. Hope you found that interesting.
Thank you, Adam. Just for questions, this is being recorded, so if you don't mind, you can use the mic, or if you're too lazy to use the mic, Adam, can you repeat the questions in the mic?
Yes, I can deal with laziness. That's fine. Yes, Colin.
Yeah. My question is about engagements with MOOCs. From Monash University, so I'm a white fellow and teaching students in a university environment. I'm already, even in the, I've worked for about a decade in universities. When I started to where I am now, I can see that there has been a deterioration in engagements from students, even in the classroom. Now, there's a whole bunch of reasons for that. Some of that is technology, and the fact that they can access material very easily. So they don't have to spend the time writing, reading, and so on. They can just sort of print things out and whatnot. And I'm worried that the MOOCs is sort of a further evolution of that sort of technological development, which is making it possible to feel like you're really engaged in learning when actually you're only learning at a very much a surface level. So that's a sort of comment, I guess. It's sort of a bit muddled a little bit with your comments about the FIA qualification. I think the FIA qualification is a separate issue. The profession, keep hold of that and make sure that people who become FIAs are suitable to become FIAs. And I wouldn't worry that MOOCs would deteriorate that qualification anyway. But my question is, do you think that MOOCs, with MOOCs it's possible to increase engagement? I don't think even getting engagement where it is now is probably still not adequate. Engagement is not there at the moment.
So to try and summarise that question for the microphone, I'm going to summarise it in my own way. What impact will MOOCs have on engagement of students? Engagement is multifaceted. It's very, very hard to sort of answer that question in any simple way. I think that engagement is largely driven by students seeing the value in what they're doing. And so if they see the value in the end point, then they will engage in the process. In terms of that's largely affected by design in courses as well. So if all the questions in my course, for example, were multiple choice questions, then that's going to encourage students to try and game the system and work out a way to answer the questions in as efficient way as possible from their point of view. Although that said, they're not sitting it for credit or anything like that, so they might, the better students will see beyond that anyway. I think you can design a MOOC that improves upon that. I mean, the way I tried to do it is the later questions in the course, you have to sit down and make a number of changes to a spreadsheet to have any chance of getting the right answer at all. But it's a tough one. I mean, I hate to say back in my day, but things have changed so much. I'm not sure even though I've got a fair bit of experience in this area now, I don't really understand the engagement issue completely. What's your view, Colin?
Well, so one issue that I think is one gap that's appearing now, and this is sort of my own observation, but also coming from speaking to employers who are looking to take on actuarial graduates and are looking for graduates with certain skills, is that there seems to be this growing gap in terms of problem solving. So it's not necessarily that students come out to university and they don't understand what small x means or, you know, what mortality table is, but employers want them to be able to sit with a blank sheet of paper with a new problem, something that's never been dealt with before, and to be able to think through an appropriate process to get to a kind of answer. And I think it's, my own opinion is that with a MOOC it's nearly possible to try and share that experience of how you solve a problem with a student. And that's how they'll learn how to solve problems, is by watching you think through solving the problem. So, you know, back in the old days, you were doing mathematics, you were watching the lecturer write things on the blackboard, and he was getting it wrong, and he was doing it again, and you were somehow seeing his thoughts come out of his head, and you were thinking, oh, that's how he's addressed this problem. And you did that enough times, you could learn how to address the problem yourself. And I think there's a massive gap there now in what graduates are coming up with, that they're not getting that experience anymore.
Interesting. I'll come to you in a moment. The whole watching someone solve a problem, to an extent I'm trying to deal with that in this course by having the video solutions and making a mistake and coming back to it. I vividly remember a couple of videos that I filmed where I realised 3/4 of the way through that I'd completely mucked something up. And luckily by that point in time I'd become sort of decent enough at video editing that you don't want me to be sitting there for 5 minutes in the video trying to solve the problem, because it would just be weird and no, everyone would turn off. But what I did manage to do is I filmed the video, cut the bits out where I'm actually just diagnosing what the problem is, but I would actually leave the bit in where I would go, and if you've got this far, I've actually made a mistake earlier in this video and this is the mistake I've made, go back to it, fix the mistake up, and which I think is hugely valuable. I could have just tried to hide it in some way or another, but you're right, it's hard. Yes. Microphone. Excellent.
Okay, is that working? I'm Roseanne Harris, I'm from South Africa. So I wear two hats, actually. I'm president of the Actuarial Society of South Africa, but I'm also teaching at Wits University. Now, I have several challenges in these two roles. The first is that in my role in the Actuarial Society, we have the challenge of a really diabolical maths basis for people in the public education system, particularly our black students. And so we are trying to provide additional support to those students coming through, which is why the presentation is hugely useful and relevant to us. The other is in my university environment. I don't know if you've heard about Fees Must Fall experiences, which were quite, and led to us having to think of ways to reach our students when we had the problem of just accessing campus. So we have to sort of engage with all of these things. So one of the things I can share with you is that we have started, particularly for our black students, we've started what we call the Actuarial Society Academy to provide additional support. And so it's interesting that the debate, because I think what we've found in providing sort of online experience through Moodle as a tool is that it's not one or the other. It's kind of in support of. So that's why I'm pleased to see that you're positioning this as an introduction to, and then, you know, to get those other skills, you need to engage in the face-to-face teaching. But perhaps in terms of that creating access, which is one of our big challenges, you know, that's a role that it plays. It's not one or the other. It's a tool that will help in that education process. So I can refer you to YouTube videos that we have made. We have MJ, the student actuary, who is really funny. He's actually one of my students, so I'm quite proud of him. And he started off his own bat making these YouTube videos where he would work through a past paper. And so we actually engaged him as the Actuarial Society to make some YouTube videos to help now with the support. But as you say, it's very difficult to measure that engagement. And I guess that's my question, is how do you measure that students are properly engaging? It's like I'm always saying to the students when I see them in the corridor taking photographs of the solutions we put on the notice board, like now it's in your phone, but it's still not in your brain. And the other one is that evaluation mechanism. And I mean, I can see from your presentation that, you know, it's a tool towards the evaluation, but the ultimate evaluation is still the exam. I mean, one of the questions I have is, one of the challenges we've had is the discussion forums, is how do you keep the discussion forums going without there being an expert participant in those forums? Because then you need to have the volunteers and, you know, being involved. And we've tried a system whereby we set a question each week and they swap and mark. We use this tool to randomly, but it's, they're very enthusiastic for the first 2 weeks and then it falls off. So I guess my comments and then my question is really, how do you sort of keep that engagement through the course? So I guess I'm encouraged to see your numbers because it makes me feel that we're not doing so badly. Because as you say, what you get at the end is still a success.
I mean, this is a slightly flippant answer to a very detailed question, but inevitably, if you want students to behave in a certain way, you have to count it as part of the assessment. It is the motivational tool. So in previous courses where I wanted discussion forum participation, you just got to allocate a few marks to it. And then you hope that students will see the value of it on top of the 5% that you're giving them and actually engage with it in a fairly deep way. Again, maybe you have to design it a certain way. I've taught courses in the past where marks for discussion forum participation, but you don't get marks for, yes, I agree with that. Like, you've actually got to add something to the discussion to get marks. You do have to be in it, or you've got to find a robot who can go through it and pass that.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, but thank you, Adam. That was very, very interesting, and I think you've done a great job. So I'll give you a customary bottle of wine for you to drink on the way back to Canberra.
In the plane. Thank you very much. Thank you. Appreciate it.